Our lakes are living, breathing systems, even in the depths of winter. We're at the lake here on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and our guide likes slow boat rides around Birch Lake in Oneida County, a box of worms and sheep rods, and a seat on the pier bench, watching the subtle changes of the season against the backdrop of a sunset. What is your favorite lake? What questions do you have about fishing the lakes? What's your best ice skating, fishing, or snowmobiling memory? Share yours, 800-642-1234. Ted Rolsey is editor and publisher of several books on the Great Lakes region. He writes the column, The Lake Where You Live, and he's active in lake advocacy groups. He wrote a Lakeside Companion that's published by the University of Wisconsin Press, and he joins us from our studios in Wausau. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, we affectionately call you the lake guy in here, and it was so fun to be able to bring you back as we get closer to the cold, snowy Wisconsin winter. Why should we pay attention to our lakes in winter?
Well, because they're just a great deal of fun. They're just a wonderful place to be in the winter. Some of us, we kind of hunker down for the winter and stay indoors. But if you live on a lake, I wouldn't say it's my favorite time to be on the lake, but it's still an awesome time to be on the lake.
Why is it so awesome?
Well, there's just a certain magic to the ice and to being able to get out there and walk on this surface where before you obviously couldn't. You could take boat rides around the lake in the summertime, but in wintertime, you can actually take a walk around your lake, around the outside or across down the middle once the ice is hard enough. One of my favorite things to do on Birch Lake where I live is to take a long walk around the complete circumference of the lake, which is about a 2.5 to 3 mile walk. Do this before the snow gets too deep. It's just a really nice experience.
When do you know it's okay to go out on that ice?
Oh, I have what I call the rock test. I'll find a couple of rocks about as big as my fist, and then I'll stand on the shore and I'll throw one of these rocks as high and far as I can so it gets out to a decent distance. And then you can kind of tell by what happens to the rock how thick the ice is. If it just goes crashing right through, you know it's not safe. Sometimes it'll make kind of a pook sound like that. And if it does that, you know the ice is getting firm, but it's still not very stable. But if it sounds like just like it would if it landed on a sidewalk, bang, then I'm okay to venture out. And I'll step out slowly and just a little bit at a time so that if I break through, all I'll get is wet feet or wet up to the knee. And then I'll look for a crack in the ice. When you see a crack in the ice, you can kind of tell the actual thickness of it from looking at that crack.
How clear is that ice when you start out in the winter months?
Well, it can be window clear. Unfortunately for me, we've lived on our lake 6.5 years now, full time. And each time the ice has come in, a sheet has formed, the snow has come the day after, about 1 inch of snow. But in a place where we lived previously, that didn't happen. The ice would freeze. It would be window clear. I was actually on a river up above a dam, and you can see through the ice just like a window onto that world underwater, and you can go along in your ice skates, and fish will be swimming along. You can follow these fish, and it's even a neater experience, I think, than snorkeling in the summertime. Suspended animation.
We're talking with nature writer Ted Rolsey. He's our guide to Wisconsin lakes in the winter. He's the author of A Lakeside Companion, and he joins us from Wausau this morning. What is the lake that you most enjoy in the winter months? Share your stories about fishing, snowshoeing, maybe skating on the lakes. Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ted, before we get too deep into winter, let's fall back, if you will, discuss the change that our lakes go through in the fall. How are these ecosystems changing and preparing for the colder weather ahead?
Yeah, good question. I like to think of winter on our lakes actually as starting in the fall. In the summertime, the lake is stratified with warmer water on top and colder water on the bottom. Then as fall comes on, the surface water cools and the lower layer and the upper layer mix, and wind comes along, wind and wave action, and infuses the lake with oxygen. It's sort of like your lake taking a nice, deep, cleansing breath. And that we call that the fall turnover. And after the fall turnover, the lake is completely infused with oxygen, which is good because the fish and the frogs and the turtles that live under the ice are going to need that oxygen to get through the winter. Another nice thing about that is as the water gets colder, colder water holds a lot more oxygen than warmer water does. So that when the water gets down to the freezing point or so, it's holding almost twice as much oxygen as it would at, say, 80 degrees water temperature in the summertime. So going into winter, the creatures that are going to live under the ice have more oxygen than they will at any other time of year. And that's how they get through the winter, that long period when the lake is essentially sealed off.
How do those waves that you see on the water in the late fall, are they helping circulate that oxygen?
Yeah, they are. It creates a mixing action that helps infuse the lake with oxygen. That's a really important thing that happens in the fall.
You've written about steam fog or water smoke on a lake. Can you tell us about what's going on there?
Right. The water cools more slowly than the air. And so what happens when you in October, November, as the air temperature gets pretty cold, you'll get days where there's very cold air over much warmer water underneath. So we have warmer air rising off the water, hitting that colder air above, and it forms these tendrils of what looks like steam. And it's kind of a nice fall phenomenon if you can observe that on your lake.
Oh, sure. Watching that and also taking some pictures. Do you do much photography?
I do a little. I used to have a pretty extensive camera outfit, but now, like a lot of people, I pretty much rely on my phone. But I take pictures of new ice. I take a lot of pictures of sunsets sitting on our pier, not necessarily in winter.
Yeah, what do you love about your pier as you see the changing of the seasons?
Oh, it's just a great place to sit and watch the seasons go by. I don't really do a lot of fishing from our pier. We don't get a lot of fish that come in close, but when I come in off the boat, I usually like to sit on the bench for a while and just watch what's going on. We have, of course, we have blue herons, we have eagles, we have loons, we have, and every year so far, we've had a family of hooded mergansers, little tiny chicks following their mom along the water.
Oh, adorable. What do you hear out there on the pier?
Well, that depends on the season. You hear a lot of bird calls. I like the call of the kingfisher. It kind of sounds like a motor that's not running quite right. We hear the eagles calling overhead. Of course, the loon calls. Our little grandsons just love the loons. They like to sit on the bench, and our grandson Tucker likes to think he can call the loons in. He makes an imitation loon call, and sometimes the loons actually come closer, not necessarily because of his call, but he likes to think he's calling them in.
Well, it's always the effort, right?
Right, right.
What about in winter? What happens? Does it get still?
Oh, it's wonderfully still, especially before the ice gets hard enough for the snowmobile trail to open. It's just a certain kind of silence that pervades. Most of the people are gone over the winter. We only have a few full-time residents on our lake. And so it's just a very soothing, quiet, deep, deep silence.
We're talking with our lake guy, Ted Ralsey, and we're exploring lake ecosystems, why these environments are so beautiful, so fragile, and really quite active, more than we realize. Do you ever wonder about what's going on under the water in the winter? What questions do you have about the fish, the plants, the wildlife in and around our lakes? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with more Wisconsin Weekend and Ted Ralsey here on the Ideas Network. We're visiting our lakes on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lake Winnebago is the largest inland lake by volume and the lake with the longest shoreline. Walleye and sturgeon thrive there. Vilas County boasts the most lakes, but it's Birch Lake where writer Ted Rolce makes his home, finds inspiration, and treads as lightly as possible to ensure its future. Tell us about the lake you live on or those near you. What do you notice during the winter months? Do you have questions about how to be a good steward of your lake? What can you do to take care of the waters? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lake writer Ted Rolce stays with us. Ted, you know, as we look at what variables have to fall in place for the lake to begin freezing, how does that work? What has to come together in order to make that ice?
We need cold weather and we need calm weather. When you have windy weather, the lake tends not to freeze over because the wave action is going to keep stirring up those tiny ice crystals that want to form. The action of the waves keeps breaking that up and keeps the surface from freezing. So we can have very cold nights and still the water won't freeze. Another reason why the water won't freeze is the warmer water is actually below the surface water is the coldest. So when there's wave action, it's stirring up slightly warmer water from below. So what happens is that the water gets down to about the freezing temperature, and then it takes a nice, cold, still night for that sheet to form.
What happens to the fish? Where do they go?
They stay there. They're there under the water. And
I mean, are they more toward the surface, toward the ice, or are they down lower?
That kind of depends on the conditions. Generally, you'll find them in much the same places where you would in the summertime. In Fisherman magazine says that the fish tend to follow the oxygen, which in the late winter when it's really cold, there will be more oxygen near the surface. And so you find fish in the shallower water at those times. Otherwise, they'll be hanging out on the rock bars, in the brush piles, in the cribs that people place, and going about their activities. Some of them are more active in the wintertime than others. For example, fish like northern pike, bluegills, perch, walleyes are still fairly active, and that's mostly what the ice fishermen catch. And when it comes to largemouth and smallmouth bass and muskies, they're a lot more sluggish in the winter. It's not that you never catch them through the ice, but you're just not as likely to.
You do a bit of ice fishing, is that right?
I do. I must admit, I finally succumbed to the urge. For a long time, I had a college chemistry teacher who told me most of what people do while ice fishing, I can do in my living room. But I deviated from his advice a few years ago. I used to think, boy, what a hassle, taking all that gear, this sled and this ice drill and this ice skimmer and these rods and buckets and all this stuff. And in the summertime, I can just grab a box of leeches and a rod and get in the boat and go. But then I got out there. I thought, well, I live on a lake. I might as well try it. So I got myself a hand auger and a couple of jig rods and just gave it a try, and lo and behold, I really liked it. If you actually find some fish, there's just a certain you have to be so in the moment. It's almost passing into Zen, so in the moment, because the bite of these fish in the wintertime, because they are not as active as they are in summer, it's just this tiny, tiny little tick-tick that you have to feel through the rod, and it's really nice escape to be so in the moment. It's impossible to worry and fish at the same time, and I think that's especially true in ice fishing.
I loved it when you wrote this, that you took up the hobby of ice fishing with, quote, the sort of excitement I feel when I finally set aside a day to do my taxes. Where did that thought come from?
Well, because it was something I was kind of actually reluctant to do, just thinking of hauling all this gear down and bundling up and standing out there on the ice freezing. And my natural fear of failure kicked in, too. I probably won't catch anything anyway. I don't know what I'm doing. But I gave it a try, and it's really a nice diversion. And what I discovered or figured out is that you don't have to stay out there all day. You don't have to go out from 6 in the morning to 6 at night. You just pick a time of day that's hospitable, which on my lake is toward dusk. And you go out there for an hour or two, and no law says you have to stay out there if you get cold.
We're talking with lake writer Ted Rulsey as our guide as he shares what he loves about Birch Lake and all the lakes in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email about your favorite lake, ideas@WPR.org. Ted, do you have a shed or some shelter out there on the lake when you go out?
I don't. I've thought about it, but I don't really have a place where I could store it. I've thought about getting one of these pop-up shelters, and I might well do that. You can just they're light. They're fabric and with a lightweight frame, and you just take it out on the ice and pop it up, and then you've got to anchor it down somehow so the wind won't blow it away on you. So that's something that I would consider. It would get me out of the wind, make things a little more pleasant. I've kind of hesitated to invest too much money in this sport that I'm still actually a little bit dipping my toe into.
What is the sound coming from the ice? What is that booming sound that you hear?
Yeah, the ice is always expanding and contracting. And when I was a kid, I was out skating with a friend one time. We were on a river, and we heard the ice booming, and we thought, oh, my God, the ice must be breaking up. So we laid down flat on the ice, prostrated ourselves so we'd reduce our pressure on the ice. But the ice was probably a foot thick, and we were perfectly safe. But the ice is constantly expanding and contracting, and the fact that you hear booming doesn't mean that the ice is weak. There's an interesting sensation when the ice is still somewhat thin, maybe 2 or 3 inches. I've had it happen where all of a sudden you hear this sizzling sound coming toward you, and I've actually had one of these cracks sizzle right past me or right between my legs when I've been out ice skating. And it's a little bit of an unnerving sensation, but it doesn't mean that the ice is weak. It just means it's doing what nature intended. It's expanding, contracting with changing temperature. And that's what you get with ice booming. It's the same basic thing. It's a can be a really interesting sound. I've heard sometimes it's a loud boom. Sometimes it almost sounds like a cross between a drum and a bell. It's a kind of a melodic sound almost.
Hmm. And you hear it when you're out ice fishing as well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And sometimes in the house at night, if you happen to have a window open and you're on a lake, you might hear the booming.
Tell us about the crystals and where we can see these ice crystals on a lake.
Well, you don't really see the crystals until springtime. I'll get to that in a second. But ice is not actually a monolithic substance like we tend to think of it. It's actually a set of hexagonal crystals that grow downward from the surface, and they're all packed in tightly together. And they just grow down from the surface of the water, and you don't see it, but it's really a crystalline substance. And then what happens in the springtime is as the ice starts to melt, those crystals start to separate. And if you're walking out on ice that is – they call that candled because these crystals actually come apart and kind of look like candles. If you're walking on candled ice, or sometimes it's called rotten ice, the ice can be a foot thick and you can still break right through because that crystalline structure is so weakened. And a really neat thing that can happen in winter, if you get an ice shove that pushes ice up onto the shore, and this is candled ice, you could actually walk up to these chunks of ice and tap on them, and these ice candles will fall off, and it sounds almost like a chimes. It's a musical sound.
Oh, how gorgeous. So what does it look like right now on Birch Lake? What are you seeing out there?
Boy, the ice conditions, I'd say, are kind of dicey. We had this long spell of cold weather. Then it got warm, and it rained, and it slushed. Yeah. And I see right now some there's snow on the surface. There's still some snow after the rain came. There's some patches of open water. It just doesn't look like very nice ice at all. And I'm hoping that maybe we'll get a thaw that'll smooth out the surface. I've had a couple of – I'm the education coordinator for my lake group, which is the Friends of Birch Lake, and I've had a couple of friends ask me – who don't live in the area, what are the ice conditions like because they want to go fishing. So I have to investigate that for them. Over the weekend, I imagine I'll be stepping out there and seeing what I can discover.
Yeah, so it's a lot of watching and waiting and looking for little telltale signs in nature.
Right, right.
That's beautiful. So how can we be a better steward of our lakes? How can we take care of them? You tread very lightly.
Yeah, we've chosen to. When we bought our place, we bought a lot. I'd always thought we would buy an existing house so we wouldn't add to the construction on the lakes. But as it turned out, we bought a vacant lot, a wooded lot, and built our little house there. And when we got our house, we got the county shoreland zoning ordinance, and not to find out all the nasty red tape we would have to follow, but to find out what we could really do, what were the minimum standards that we should follow. We followed everything that the zoning ordinance required, and we did things that we weren't required to do, such as one of the best things you can do for a lake is keep the shoreline natural, and we've definitely tried to do that. I can talk more about that later on if you'd like.
Absolutely. We're checking in with lake columnist Ted Ralsey as we gaze out upon our favorite lakes and anticipate the ice sheet. What curiosities do you have about our freshwater sources? Do you have a Wisconsin lake that's your favorite? Tell us why. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. There's more Wisconsin Weekend with Ted Ralsey right after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's science and a whole lot of heart for our beautiful and fragile lakes in this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Ted Ralsey is our guide. He writes the Lake Where You Live column, and he finds that even in the depths of winter, his lake, Birch Lake, is an absolute treasure. A sheet of white, a blank canvas in which creatures will write new chapters each night to be revealed in daytime. It's reflections from his book, A Lakeside Companion. What do you want to know about how to be a good steward of our lakes? Join in at 800-642-1234 as Ted Ralsey takes your lake questions and ideas. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Ted, as we are talking about with your move to Birch Lake and building a home on the shore, what steps did you take to make sure you were able to do so responsibly and remaining, you know, stewards of the water?
Well, the main thing we did was build a modest house so that we're not making too much of a footprint on the land, because what we do on the land affects what goes on in the water. The other major thing that we did was leave the shoreline natural. We have a wooded lot. We had to clear trees, obviously, for the house and the septic system. We preserved the trees that we could. But then the County Shoreland Protection Ordinance says that you're allowed to cut a 35-foot-wide strip of trees down to the water to give yourself a viewing corridor. And we chose not to do that. We basically cut nothing. We cut a couple of little struggling saplings right down where there's a flat area next to the lake so we could have a fire pit down there. But basically, we left the trees alone, and we have what we might call a filtered view of the water. And another reason for doing that is I think when we live on lakes, we need to think not just of our own properties, but of what other people see when they're out on the lake and they look back at the shoreline. Because people who come up north don't want to look at lawns and not necessarily at houses. They would rather see natural beauty, trees, conifers, deciduous trees. And so when you're out on the lake, you can kind of just barely see our house up on the hill. And that's kind of the way we like it. It's not the way everybody has to do it. It's just what we've chosen.
How does your lake approach keeping the invasives out, the invasive species?
Well, I wish that we were better protected. We have we don't have a public boat launch per se. Most of the invasive species hitchhike into the lake on boats, of course. We don't have a public launch, but we do have a bar and resort. And people who rent the resort cabins are able to obviously access the lake, and all that's fine. But what we don't have that a lot of lakes do is we don't have a good volunteer network of people inspecting boats under what's called the Clean Boats, Clean Waters program. And because of that, we are vulnerable to an invasion of invasive species. So far, we've been spared that, possibly because the boat traffic coming from the outside is limited. We do have rusty crayfish, which are kept under control by fish predation and by some trapping that the Friends of Birch Lake does. But we are susceptible to invasive species. It's always a concern, and I think it's something that we need to address as a lake group.
Are you susceptible to the algae blooms each year?
We have very modest algae blooms sometimes, not every year, and they really aren't serious. There are some lakes that are subject to really noxious algae blooms where you get mats of algae build up along the shoreline, and the blue-green algae is what causes those. And the blue-green algae actually emit toxins such that you don't want your kids or your pets swimming in the water. The toxicity will actually, I've been told that if your dog gets affected by this blue-green algae toxin, your dog might not even make it to the vet when you find out that he's sick.
Mm.
So we get a little bit of pea soupy color in late August and into September some years, but I wouldn't really characterize it as a serious problem. We're fortunate in that way.
You've called shoreline buffers the best gift you can give to your lake to mitigate algae. What can you do on the shoreline?
Yeah, shoreline buffers are, it's a very simple and very obvious way to help keep nutrients out of the water. When we build on our lake shores, we create impervious surfaces and where rain can't soak into the ground, instead runs off down the hill toward the water. And that will carry nutrients with it. And what a shoreline buffer does, you can create a shoreline buffer. First of all, you don't have to create one. If you buy a property that's already natural, leave it that way. That's what we did. But if you've bought a property that, say, has mowed grass going down to the lake, one of the ways to create a shoreline buffer is to just stop mowing the grass from 20, 30, 40 feet from the lake edge inland. And you can also do plantings of native plants if you want to invest a little money and create something a little more beautiful. Some people have done a really great job with that. But what that does is, as this runoff is coming down from down your slope to the lake, instead of running right into the water over grass, which has very limited ability to capture runoff, it's going to hit this layer of dense vegetation. And that's going to slow down the water. It's going to soak into the soil, and the nutrients are going to feed the plants in that shoreline buffer instead of feeding the algae and the weeds in the lake.
What do the fish feel about those buffers?
Well, it's better for the lake just to not have an overabundance of nutrients. Mm-hmm. And so the fish are happy with that.
We're talking with Ted Rolsey. He writes the column, The Lake Where You Live, and he's active in lake advocacy organizations. Do you take your family out to the lakes in the winter or the summer or any season? What are your traditions? What's important to you about interacting with our many freshwater bodies? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ted, one of ice's most fun or hazardous characteristics is its slip factor, and scientists don't actually know what makes ice slippery, which is really fascinating. What theories are out there?
Well, we were taught in school that what makes the ice slippery is that the pressure of our skate blades or whatever we have on raises the temperature of the ice and so creates a thin film of water that we slide on. The scientists have pretty much disproven that. What they now believe, and I guess there are two schools of thought, and it's not entirely settled, but one is that it's the friction of the skate blade or your shoe or your boot that causes the melting of the ice and creating that thin film of water. And there's another school of thought that says the ice is inherently somewhat slippery because the water molecules on the surface are vibrating more, they're in a more fluid state, so that even when at a very low temperature, there's still a very thin layer of water on the ice, and we slide on that. But as I say, there's two schools of thought, and probably would be an interesting argument to hear some scientists talk about it.
some things you have to just remain a mystery. You know, people drive out on the ice, and that always just really makes me nervous. How strong does that ice have to be to handle that truck or car?
Well, there was a folk tale when I was growing up that 2 inches of ice would hold a team of horses. Anyway, that's what I was told. Well, it turns out, don't trust that bit of wisdom. There's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has issued some guidelines. They say that less than 1.75 inches keep off the ice. If it's 1.75 inches or a little bit more, one person on skis. 2 inches, one person on foot or on skates. Then for an automobile, they say 7 inches. For a pickup truck, 8 inches. For a larger truck, say 14,000 pounds, 10 inches. So those are guidelines. I tend to be very conservative in when I go out. I don't know that I would ever drive my car out onto ice. It seems perfectly safe. People do it, but every year there are cars that break through. I guess the bottom line is if in doubt, don't go out. Be careful because you don't want to end up in that water.
Ted, you're a grandfather. How do you pass on your love for and your appreciation of the lake, of Birch Lake, and all of the lakes out there in Wisconsin?
Mainly just getting them out there. Our grandsons, one of my little subversive grandfather things has been to try and turn my two grandsons into lake lovers and Northwoods addicts like I am. Mm-hmm. And so we spend as much time down on the water as we can. We like to take the pontoon boat and take a nice slow ride around the lake and let them observe all the things that we see, the loons on the water, the eagles flying over. The boys love to fish. We do get some bluegills that come to the side of our dock, and they just love to dangle a little nightcrawler in the water and catch a bluegill. So it's just immersing them figuratively and literally in the lake. Kids just naturally love it.
In winter, we have a better idea of what animals who live around the lake, what they're up to, because they leave tracks. Can you give us some winter wildlife tracking advice?
Oh, the most fun thing about, I mentioned I take walks around the lake when the snow is not too deep. And one of the coolest things about that is on our lake we have otters, and we see otter slides. It's very interesting. If there's a animal that knows how to have fun, it's otters. And the way they get around in the wintertime is they don't just run along the snow. They'll take a few running steps, and then they'll slide on their belly, take a few more steps, slide again. So if you're following an otter track, you're seeing footprints and then a sausage-shaped slide mark in the snow, then more footprints and so on. And you can actually follow that trail of otter slides to maybe a hole in the ice where they've been going through to capture food, or maybe to a den of theirs under the uprooted roots of a tree or under someone's dock, or maybe just up onto the shoreline and they're gone into the woods. Then there's also, we see deer tracks, we see tracks of tiny tracks of mice, lots of interesting animal scripts get written overnight.
Author and columnist Ted Ralsey is our guide. What is your favorite lake and what draws you to it? Share the beauty of your lake on a winter morning. Join in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll continue the conversation with our lake guy, Ted Ralsey, in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're trading lake stories on Wisconsin Weekend, learning about the ecosystems. Thanks for being here. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we make our way around the lakes, let's keep an eye out for the wood ducks. Keep an eye out for an eagle, perhaps, a great blue heron. What do you spot through your binoculars these days? What are you learning about your lake and the creatures that live in and around it? You can join in 800-642-1234. Ted Ralsey calls Birch Lake home in Oneida County. He writes the column, The Lake Where You Live, and he stays with us. Ted, you're involved in your own lake advocacy group for Birch Lake. What do groups like yours need help with the most? How can people get involved in lake groups?
Well, the most important thing that lake associations need is unanimous or near unanimous participation from the property owners. I talk to lake associations all the time, talking about the basics of lake science and other things. And one of the things I hear from them is, well, we only have 30% or 50% or 60% of our property owners as members. And on Birch Lake, we're more fortunate than that. I would hazard a guess that we have 80 to 90% participation and really good alignment among the people about what we want our group to try and do for the lake. But so the first thing associations need is full participation. The other thing I think they need is resources. These are extremely dedicated people. It's just give their lives to protecting their lakes. And it would be really great if there could be more funding to do things like lake management studies and invasive species prevention, clean boats, clean waters programs. So much now depends on volunteers, and volunteers get burned out. It's usually a small group of people in any lake association who do most of the work. So more funding for lake improvement would really be a help to lake associations.
How often do you meet up with your fellow, your fellow lake people in the association, and how do you communicate?
Our association board members, I used to be on the board. I'm not now. I'm the education coordinator, which is not a board position, but the board usually meets about a half dozen times a year. We communicate with our members through a electronic newsletter, and then in my role as education coordinator, I send out periodic messages, just sometimes something interesting about the lake. Other times, like right now, everybody wants to know when the ice is forming and what are the ice conditions and what's the fishing like. So I try to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on there.
You turn into scout.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You know, Wisconsin, we're lucky enough to be bordered by two of the Great Lakes. What should we be looking for on the Great Lakes in the wintertime?
Boy, that's an area where I don't have a lot of expertise. One of the things that's neat about Lake Michigan, I grew up on Lake Michigan in Two Rivers, and one of the cool things about winter there is you get these humpy ice mounds that build up along the shoreline, and you see the waves crashing into them and splashing up big sprays of water, and that's really cool. But other than that, I don't spend a lot of time on the Great Lakes in winter.
Are there any other lakes that you appreciate and enjoy getting out to besides Birch Lake, your home?
Am I allowed to mention lakes that aren't in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes.
I have a very favorite lake where my family used to spend a week of summer vacation every year. It's just north of Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin, maybe 2 or 3 miles into Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And I was introduced to that lake when I was 8 years old. And believe it or not, I still fish it I fish it every year. I might have missed one year here and there, but it's still a favorite place of mine. And the cabin where we used to stay is still there right next to the boat landing. So that's a very favorite lake of mine, and I learn something new about it every time I go there, even after 60 years.
Oh, wow. Every lake has a story and a different type of piece to it.
That's right.
Ted, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed the hour.
Ted Ralsei is the author of A Lakeside Companion. He's also a writer and columnist, and you can find him on Birch Lake. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look at the history of Wisconsin's name.
We recently received a flurry of questions through the Wisconsin Project from the fourth grade class at Mineral Point Elementary School. Most of the questions were about the state of Wisconsin. Questions like, how did Wisconsin get all of its cows? And who invented the state dog? We sent WPR's Mary Kate McCoy to investigate.
When I saw these questions come in, I got really excited. It's because I'm from Mineral Point, and one question in particular stood out to me, from Josie Dunn. Because, full disclosure, I've known Josie for a long time.
Josie, we know each other, don't we?
Yeah.
How do we know each other?
You were my old babysitter.
Mm-hmm. We had some fun, didn't mm-hmm. we? You wrote a question to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and what was your question?
How did Wisconsin get its name?
And why do you want to know the answer to that?
Because Wisconsin's a really unique name for a state, and I just really wanted to know why it was mainly called Wisconsin.
And what do you think the answer is?
Maybe the person who, like, lived in the state didn't really have a name yet. Maybe made Wisconsin a state and named it after him.
And are you excited to find out the answer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that's a somewhat tricky question to answer. But what we do know is that it came from the Algonquian language family, spoken by Wisconsin tribes like the Menominee, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Mohican. And it certainly was not pronounced Wisconsin.
I was always told it was Wiscosec, and some people have said Wisconsin. There's a Wiscosec, a Wiscosec.
Napoose is an elder in residence at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, a member of the Menominee tribe.
To translate that would be basically the first part comes from the word Wishkiu, which means something good, and that ending is more, what you would say, locative. Then you would say a good place to, like, camp or to make a clearing or to basically live.
Rand Valentine is a University of Wisconsin-Madison Linguistics and American Studies professor. He offers another interpretation.
The word Wisconsin originates from an Algonquian language word, meskusing. And meskusing is probably Miami, Illinois language, but possibly Ojibwe. It's a little bit uncertain. And the word translates as where it lies red. And the best guess is that's making reference to the red cliffs around the Dells.
But once the French got a hold of the word, Napoose says its pronunciation started to change.
The big confusion, though, was when the French came in. A lot of those names were mistranslated because basically they couldn't pronounce them.
Many scholars trace a European adoption of the name Wisconsin to the missionary and explorer Father Jacques Marquette. Valentine says the change came after he traveled across Wisconsin from Green Bay to the Mississippi River with fur trader Louis Joliet and two Miami Indians as guides.
He recorded this word as their word for the Wisconsin River. They themselves were refugees here in Wisconsin. There was lots of turmoil in the 17th century.
So then where did the W come from? Valentine says that came from a simple misreading of the text.
There was a famous map maker, and he showed the name to LaSalle, who mistook the first two letters, which were just this very flamboyant M, as O-I, which he interpreted as we.
Over time, as more English speakers settled into the area, the French spelling was changed to the more English W. Napoose and Valentine agree that knowing where the name comes from is powerful.
If you're a language speaker, you should know what that means by breaking it down. And that's the importance of language, because if you don't have that quality, then you're just reciting.
When we recognize that this state's very name comes from one of the languages of the country's first people, it will perhaps give us a greater appreciation for their place, not just in the past, but in the present.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us this story. And Josie's question came to us through the Wisconsin Project. Submit your own questions and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. What's happening in your part of the state that could reach all corners of Wisconsin? Send your ideas for Wisconsin Weekend to mornings@WPR.org. That's mornings@WPR.org, and we'll explore your tip for a Wisconsin Weekend program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Wisconsin Weekend on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.